From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump still has not conceded the election. In fact, he's making key personnel decisions, announcing on Twitter today that he's fired his defense secretary, Mark Esper. None of this has stopped President-elect Joe Biden from getting to work on his transition to the White House. Today, Biden announced the members of his coronavirus task force. Here he is.
I'm humbled by the trust and confidence the American people have placed in me and in Vice President-elect Harris. And we're ready to get to work addressing the needs of the American people. Today, that work begins. It starts with doing everything possible to get the COVID-19 under control.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. And Mara, what else did we hear Joe Biden talk about today in that press conference?
Joe Biden talked about the coronavirus. He said Americans will have to rely on masking, distancing, contact tracing, hand washing, and other measures to keep themselves safe well into the next year. He was referring to the announcement that Pfizer and its partner BioNTech has announced that their experimental vaccine was 90% effective. Biden said today's news is great news, but it doesn't change the fact that we have to do all these other things to keep Americans safe from the virus.
And Joe Biden is not president yet, but he's clearly trying to make a statement here. Do you think the coronavirus task force is purely symbolic, or can it accomplish something of substance before the inauguration?
No, I think it can accomplish something of substance. First of all, the bully pulpit is very important. When he talks about wearing masks, people are going to listen to him because he's the president-elect. People listened to President Trump and didn't wear masks. We don't know yet if he's going to encourage governors to mandate masks or just to encourage people to wear masks. We don't know if he's going to call for a national mandate. But I think that the change in tone is something that's important more than symbolic. He's got this task force that he announced today filled with scientists, public health officials, including one woman, Marcella Nunez-Smith, who's the assistant dean for health equity research at Yale. So clearly he's going to be looking for out for people who are the hardest hit and on the front lines.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, you do have President Trump, who's still insisting without evidence that Democrats are trying to steal the election. He's promising to continue the fight with more lawsuits. And today, just we see that he's fired his defense secretary, Mark Esper. What do you make of that?
Well, it sounds like it's just an effort to humiliate him. I mean, it doesn't really matter that he fires the defense secretary now that he's a lame duck president and he'll be out of office on January 20th. He did talk about firing people after the election. Of course, he was referring to it as he would be continuing in office. But there are a lot of people that he resents who don't feel that have served him well. He's had tremendous turnover in his administration, and it sounds like the turnover is continuing until the very last minute.
It sure does. And it is interesting to see as the process plays out how Republicans are responding. Many of them are sticking with the president. But here's Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, chairman of the Senate Rules Committee, a Republican, speaking on ABC's This Week yesterday.
It's time for the president's lawyers to present the facts, and then it's time for those facts to speak for themselves. Seems unlikely that any changes could be big enough to make a difference, but this is a close election, and we need to acknowledge that.
What do you think those comments tell you about where the Republican Party is right now with President Trump?
Well, the Republican Party doesn't want to say anything that's going to make Trump mad. This is still a Trump party. Mitt Romney said the president is going to be the 900-pound gorilla in the Republican Party for a very long time. I think he's absolutely right. So the president, there are a lot of Republicans who are trying to convince the president in very subtle ways that his legacy would be burnished if he left with a certain amount of dignity. But the president wants to fight till the very end. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of a positive feeling in the Republican Party about how well they did. They did better than they expected. But still, Republicans have now lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 elections. Donald Trump got more votes than he did last time, but still not enough to win. And that's a real problem for the party going forward post-Trump, with Trump on the sidelines very active.
NPR political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Georgia, where a recount will likely take place after Joe Biden took a razor-thin lead over President Trump. President-elect Joe Biden did not need Georgia's electoral votes to put him over the top, but he sure could use two senators from the state. Georgia is holding runoffs in two Senate races after no candidate won more than 50% of the vote. That the Democrats came as close to challenging sitting Republican senators as they did is astounding. So how did Georgia become a possible swing state after not carrying a Democratic presidential candidate since 1992? The answer lies in the work of black female political organizers who've been on the ground getting out the vote. People like Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you co-founded this group in 2016. Then, since then, traveling across the state, sometimes in a bus that says in bold letters, "We got the power." Why do you think Biden and the Democrats did so well in Georgia?
All of it really boils down to deep organizing. That the way that you win elections is organized power is realized power. Cliff Albright and I founded the organization precisely for that. We knew that in order for us to really be able to shape the kind of future that we wanted, we needed to make sure that we were building our power. And the way that you do that is you have to organize on the ground and really be able to build out the infrastructure and the ecosystem by building the capacity of grassroots black-led groups. And so that's what we've been focused on the last 4 years, we have literally been on the ground working with organizations, 25 to 40 organizations in each of the states, helping them to build their capacity, investing in those groups, like helping them to build power locally. A lot of times our work was rooted and centered in investing in local elections. And so a lot of that led to what I think we saw this victory on Saturday. Well, I guess the victory they had on Tuesday, but that was called, the race being called on Saturday. That is a result of three things, of really being able to have a message that's tailored to people. I think we had a message that we tailored to black voters, that instead of having a message that was rooted in fear, we had a message that said, you have power, that you are powerful and that you have agency. The second thing is to really be able to say that we have some resources, money. Money makes a difference. And so we were able to invest in over 600 black-led groups on the ground. And the third thing was around mobilization, having a mobilization strategy, not just a voter registration strategy. We put more, while we did voter registration, we put more emphasis and resources on the mobilization part of the strategy, opposed to just voter registration.
Well, it sounds like you're saying at the heart of it, don't cede the South to Republicans. And now we are looking at this Senate race. You have the Republican sitting Senator David Perdue, a Trump backer. He recently, you know, mispronounced Kamala Harris's name several times for fun at a rally. And then his 33-year-old Democratic challenger, investigative journalist John Ossoff, the Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed, facing the Democratic pastor Raphael Warnock. If the two Democratic candidates win, the Senate will be evenly split. Vice President-elect Harris is the tiebreaker. I mean, obviously, this is important to Democrats in Washington to get that the votes in the Senate. But how important is this to you?
You know, it's incredibly important to me. My entire adult life has been dedicated on saying the South, you know, the South is not red or blue. The South are people. And that fundamentally what you start seeing in the South is like this idea that the South was red. No, the South has been underinvested. And so part of what we showed, I think even with the Georgia race, while it was an upset to many, I mean, and some folks were really shocked, that that's 10 years of work of building power on the ground, that when you look at the demographic shifts and changes in the region, when you look at so many people who are constantly overlooked and marginalized, that what we wanted to do is really to be able to build that power. And we've done that. And I do think it is going to make a significant difference. I think it is poetic justice for that to happen in the Deep South, in Georgia, in a place that most folks in a presidential election, they write off. They don't even look at, because it's been red for so long. What I think that Georgia is reflective of is the direction of where America is going. Ultimately, I think that America is becoming more diverse, that ultimately when we look at the demographic shift in this country, and I do believe that you're starting to see multi-generational, multiracial coalitions come together. What happened in Georgia were black voters, LGBTQ voters, Asian American and Pacific Islanders, Latinx folks from the Latinx community, some of the folks who were new Americans and progressive whites, what you saw is you saw a coalition, a new coalition that is forming that I call the Rise of the New South. And so I think we're going to start seeing more of that. I think Texas is next. I think people need to pay attention to North Carolina. It wasn't by accident that this year there was a governor that was elected, a Democratic governor that was elected in Kentucky. So something is happening. There are some changes that are happening in the South, and those changes are driven by people, working class folks, who are tired of being taken advantage of by the Republican Party, who are tired of literally seeing the Republican Party have an agenda that supports the elite, that are tired of in our states in the midst of a pandemic where many of our people are most vulnerable, our states have refused to expand health care. And so I think what you're seeing is you're seeing people rise up and respond to what it is that we want going forward, a more reflective democracy.
Latasha Brown, co-founder and, as you hear, force behind Black Voters Matter and political organizer in Georgia. Latasha, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
For Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Kamala Harris has made history. The vice president-elect will become the first Black and South Asian woman to hold the second highest elected office in the country. In her victory speech Saturday night, Harris, dressed in suffragette white, gave credit to the voters.
And when our very democracy was on the ballot in this election, with the very soul of America at stake, and the world watching, you ushered in a new day for America.
Erin Haynes is founding mother and editor-at-large at the 19th, a publication focused on gender, politics, and policy. Erin, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Peter. A new day indeed.
Yeah, and just a few months ago, you joined us to talk about Harris's historic nomination. Now she appears to have cemented her place in history. Just talk about that for a moment, the enormity of this moment and what it means to so many different groups of people.
For her to be on a ticket with Joe Biden and to be elected now Madam Vice President-elect in the centennial year of suffrage, 150 years after the passage of the 15th Amendment, which gave Black men the right to vote, and 55 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the symbolism of this moment cannot be overstated. But her being this historic first will mean for so many young girls, especially young Black girls, young South Asian girls, the daughters of immigrants. I mean, she is bringing her lived experience to the White House, and it was on stage, too.
And on the campaign trail, Kamala Harris, when she visits with young girls, she'll often get down on their eye level and speak to them face to face to prove that they, in fact, can be like her someday. So that's very important for young girls and women. But what is her becoming vice president-elect? Tell us about the electorate right now, especially in this deep time of division where the country is talking about racial injustice and, in fact, is often split over the issue.
Absolutely. Well, again, she is bringing her lived experience to this role as a Black woman. She told me, as somebody who wanted to change the system from the inside, and she's somebody who, during this national reckoning on race this summer, was on the front lines with protesters in Washington. This is the kind of thing that I know a lot of the Black organizers, especially the Black women organizers, told me that they were pushing for when they were pushing for the Democratic Party to value not just their output as organizers and voters and mobilizers and donors and volunteers, but really to value them for their input in shaping what the agenda is going to be like going forward for this administration in terms of racism and, frankly, the raging pandemic. There are so many Americans, especially people of color, who are looking for a plan at the national level.
Hmm. Well, it is true that this is a historic moment, but as you know, the path ahead for Kamala Harris is likely to be very tough. Many black people in this country will expect her to push President-elect Joe Biden to carry out substantive policy changes on the issue of racial justice. I mean, how do you expect her to handle some of the pressure she's now going to feel in this office?
Well, there is a lot of attention on being the first and what that's going to mean. I mean, I think back to President Barack Obama, the country's first black president, who it had to be pointed out that he was president of the United States of America. He wasn't president of black America. And there was some frustration for black Americans who felt like he didn't do enough. We know that a president can't solve, you know, everything. And so certainly that would be true of a vice president. But people are definitely looking to her to be that voice at the table to address these issues while they are in office.
Yeah. Let's hear more from her speech on Saturday night. Harris gave credit to her mother, who you mentioned, and the generations of women who paved the way for her to break this glass ceiling. Let's listen.
She believed so deeply in an America where a moment like this is possible. And so I am thinking about her and about the generations of women, black women, Asian, white, Latina, Native American women.
Harris also said that her mother told her she may be the first at something, but to make sure that she isn't the last. So what do you think it'll take to keep the doors open for women to reach higher echelons in politics? Because it isn't going to do much good if we don't see another woman in power like this for another 50 years.
That's absolutely true and very important. I mean, look how long it took to get another woman on the presidential ticket for vice president. Representation matters. And somebody like Kamala Harris's pipeline in politics, that is a blueprint. That can be a pipeline. There still has never been a black woman to be governor of any state in our union. That matters for the country's political imagination to see women of color leading. It can be a very powerful symbol that helps to normalize that idea for Americans and also for voters, frankly, when we talk about issues of electability and who it is that we think should be allowed and able to serve in this country.
And so Kamala Harris will now be leaving the Senate. It's going to be up to California's governor to replace her. How do you think that process is going to work, and who do you think might take her seat?
I think certainly that seat will still be Democratic, but in terms of who will succeed Kamala Harris in that role, especially being that her vacancy leaves no black women serving in the Senate, I think that there will be a call for that representation to remain intact. And so among the names that I've heard, Karen Bass, Congressional Black Caucus Chair, also
considered for
Barbara
Vice
Lee.
President at one point.
You beat me to it, Peter. Yes, I mean, she, as somebody who was on that Veep Stakes process, that certainly raised her profile. Also, Barbara Lee out of California, somebody who worked on Shirley Chisholm's pioneering presidential campaign. And also London Breed, the mayor of San Francisco. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, what Governor Newsom does with this pick, because I do think that there are a lot of people, not just in California, but across the country, who will be looking to see who comes behind her in that role.
Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for the 19th, a publication focused on gender, politics, and policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, as President-elect Joe Biden moves forward with his plans to tackle the COVID-19 pandemic, schools across the country have been reopening and closing as coronavirus rates abate and now soar. And as states and local districts take different approaches to teaching, in-person, remote, a hybrid of both, many are struggling to communicate with families. In North Carolina, one school has organized a way to reach the school community, both in English and Spanish. WUNC's Liz Schlemmer reports.
With no students in the building, notes sent home in a student's backpack were out. So to reach families, staff and volunteers at Lakewood Elementary in Durham picked up their phones.
Hola, Mirna. Buenas tardes. ¿Cómo está? Le habla Julie Mendoza.
Julie Mendoza Grubbs is a volunteer at the school. Every week, she calls about a dozen families. When she saw a notice for bilingual volunteers in the neighborhood, she says the decision to help was simple.
Do I speak Spanish? There's this need for people to receive this information in Spanish. So that is something that I can do in this time when everything's so crazy.
Lakewood Elementary serves mostly Black and Brown students. A little more than half come from Spanish-speaking homes. When the pandemic shuttered schools in March, staff here came up with a plan to check on all their students. Myra Morales-Scott is an ESL teacher at the school.
My biggest concern at that point, whenever I first started contacting parents, was more so just getting to know where they were emotionally. One of my first questions to them is just, how are you doing?
She says the school didn't want to impose on families. They wanted to build relationships.
More than half of the parents that I spoke to had financial concerns.
So the school started fundraising, calling on local organizations and family and friends to donate to help the school's families. They raised more than $40,000 last spring.
We definitely were able to provide each family that did need that assistance with about $500. And we wish we could have done more.
That was just the start. Since school staff had proven they could reach almost every family, they knew they could do it again and again. Morales Scott says she's been in almost constant contact with families, and they're full of questions.
You know, it defeats the stereotype that just some of our parents don't care. They do care. It's just, it's hard for them to get in contact with teachers, especially when there's a language barrier there.
Even as the pandemic wears on, Lakewood Elementary has kept up with calling all families at least once a week. Anna Grant is the community school coordinator.
For a lot of our families, their child's school, and particularly their neighborhood public school, is the most reliable public institution that they're connected with. And so we take our responsibility really seriously, especially during this time, to make sure that our families, even if we can't resolve all of their problems, have someone who they can talk to.
Grant's job as Lakewood's community school coordinator is to form relationships with community partners, like the organizations that supported their fundraiser and the volunteers who help call parents. Another part of her job is to build strong communication with families. By calling families weekly, the school can find out what their students need and connect them with resources like Eat NC, an organization that delivers food on a weekly basis. Families say they appreciate the consistent support Lakewood Elementary gives them. Daisy Vidal is the mother of a fourth grader. She says Lakewood treats them like a member of the family.
Ha sido de bendición. Ellos nos han brindado todo el apoyo que necesitamos.
Her son's teacher calls her almost every day. And when the whole family was sick with COVID-19 over the summer, the teacher brought them food while they recovered. Vidal says it's been a blessing. Stories of teachers going above and beyond during the pandemic are plenty, but this school has made a culture out of it. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer.
Pfizer announced today that its COVID-19 vaccine is more than 90% effective, a milestone, but not yet conclusive. The news comes as the U.S. reports a 7-day average of more than 100,000 new daily cases for the first time ever. Let's bring in Dr. Joshua Sharfstein. He's Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at Johns Hopkins. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And more than 90% effective sounds very promising, but what do we still need to know before declaring victory here?
Well, I think they're still waiting for some safety data. And of course, this was a press release, so the actual underlying data will be shared with the Food and Drug Administration and be reviewed independently. Plus, they'll be bringing the information to some independent experts. So I think it is great news, and we just look forward to seeing that validated and all the information being shared and reviewed.
I think you made an important point there. We don't yet know if it's safe, right?
Well, it sounds like, according to the company, the early information is very positive on safety, but that they are waiting for a little bit more safety data before bringing it to the agency. And I think then people will look at it. So, you know, this is a process. It starts like this. It starts with some great news from the company, but then, you know, really important for people to be kicking the tires, really understanding what the data show. That is the basis for the right way to use the vaccine.
And just briefly, can you explain how the company knows that it is 90% effective? Because that would be a very high success rate.
The way the company knows that is the trial was organized where some people randomly were given a placebo, so no medicine, and other people were given the vaccine. And nobody really knows who was given what until a certain number of people get sick. Then they look, and what they saw was that pretty much all the people getting sick were people who got the placebo.
Yeah, and I don't want to leave anyone with any false impression that this vaccine would be widely available right away. So what is the process and the timeline for deploying it to the public once all that data is in and it's approved?
Right. So the first step is for the data to be submitted to the FDA, for it to be independently reviewed, and then the agency determines if it is good, then how to make it available, what process to use. It sounds like the company's been making doses this whole time and may have more than 10 million doses by the end of the year, which is terrific if that's true. So we're not like waiting to start production if it turns out the Food and Drug Administration is ready to go. And that would allow for distribution to people at the highest risk. And of course, the company would then ramp up production so that inside 2021, there'd be many more millions of doses.
And who would get those first doses?
So that process also has to play out. There's some initial recommendations that would include healthcare workers, older adults at very high risk for severe disease, and some others. What will happen is that the data will be reviewed to see if the study shows certain things that would matter for different populations, like does it look like this really does produce a strong immune reaction in older adults? And there is a committee at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that looks at that, looks at what the FDA has done, and makes essentially the key recommendations for who gets vaccinated first.
Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, Vice Dean for Public Health Practice and Community Engagement at Johns Hopkins, on this promising news from Pfizer on the vaccine. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, we started an ongoing conversation on how to go forward. In the coming weeks, we want to hear from as many voices as possible about how to move on from one of the most divisive elections in American history. But right now, we're asking how to go forward today, this week, when the president isn't even conceding that he lost the election, and now a little-known Trump appointee in the General Services Administration, Emily Murphy, is declining to sign a letter that would formally declare Joe Biden the president-elect, which would release millions of dollars in funding to Biden's transition team so they can hit the ground running in January. Instead, even things like email addresses and office space are being withheld from the Biden team, an unprecedented move that even some Republicans are criticizing. Max Steyer is president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, a nonpartisan group that houses the Center for Presidential Transition, which advises transition teams, and sent a letter asking the Trump administration to move ahead. Max, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we should say that incoming administrations always, traditionally, get started right about now doing that transition, correct? I mean, they need this time.
They absolutely need it. It's worth taking a step back and thinking about both what's at stake and what's involved in a transition. The what's involved, I'll start there, is extraordinary. You're talking about the most important, largest, and complex organization, probably not just on the planet today, but in history. And it means taking over this organization that has upwards of 4 million people, 2 million civil servants, and 2 million uniformed and reserved folk, hundreds of operating units, a budget of north of $5 trillion, and 4,000 political appointees that they need to get in place. So it, you know, puts any typical takeover in the dust. It's huge and difficult, and you need a lot of time, as much time as possible, and really great people to make it work.
And we know that there's an advisory board for the transition commission. They are from past administrations. They've all written a letter, or many have signed a letter, saying that they need this to go peacefully, and they need, you know, the president to concede, and they need this transfer of power. But now we have someone in the General Services Administration holding this up. A lot of people don't even know what that is. So tell us, why is that person playing a role in this?
So there's a law, a statute that governs the way transitions work, and it requires that the General Services Administrator ascertain, is the word that's used in the statute, a winner in order for the support that the government can give to a transition effort to allow it to happen. And so the GSA Administrator, Emily Murphy, has that responsibility to ascertain a winner. And historically, there's been, you know, no problem here. There's been a lot of clarity about, you know, who's won and no real argument about it. And that has been a pro forma decision on the part of the GSA Administrator. The only time where that was not the case was in 2000, where you had the disputed election with Al Gore and George Bush. And there, the GSA Administrator did wait until there was resolution by the Supreme Court before ascertaining a winner. So what's important to understand here is the ascertainment does not actually decide the election, but it does decide whether the Biden team gets access to critical resources that we should all want to see happen. Because in order for the Biden team to be ready on day one to govern and to address the many problems we face, they need to have all these resources, access to the agencies, their people, processed and in place, and the financial resources to do it.
Well, I want to be clear here, because you mentioned the Gore v. Bush 2000 race. The difference, it would seem to be, is that really was a razor tight race that came down to, you know, a part of Florida. In this case, we have, you know, 4.5 million more popular votes for one candidate, Joe Biden, who also got the Electoral College. Yes, there are always legal challenges after an election, but when somebody has hit that 270 and has the Electoral College, have we ever seen anything like this where this transition has been held up when there would appear to be a winner?
And the answer is no. And I think you rightly note that this is different than what occurred in 2000. There's a consensus, certainly on the media side and with the states that are at play. The issue from my perspective is that President Trump still has his legal avenues that he can pursue without interruption, whether or not the GSA Administrator ascertains Biden as the president-elect. So the key issue, in my view, is we don't even have to resolve whether any of that litigation that he wants to conduct is worthwhile or not. What we should understand is that by interrupting the ability of the Biden transition team to effectively prepare to take over the government, that increases the risk for all of us. It increases the risk that the Biden administration will not be able to move as fast to address big problems like the pandemic, like the economic issues we face, and like problems that we can't anticipate or not yet in front of us, but are undoubtedly going to come.
Yeah. Well, we are in a pandemic. And, you know, it just seems to be adding urgency to a smooth transition. Look, there have been times before when there have been pranks, right? And outgoing administration might, I think one year they removed the W's on all the keyboards in the White House, and George W. Bush was coming in a letter that would be needed. You know, again, has there ever been anything like the outgoing administration not participating in a transition?
So as you know, there certainly have been prior handoffs of power where the incumbent leaving is not happy about the person coming in. And there have been, you know, times in which there has not been a great deal of cooperation or interest sometimes on the incoming president to learn, I think, essential things from the outgoing. There hasn't been an example such as this one where the basic preparation work is held up on the basis of, again, a desire to litigate, you know, specific things. And despite the fact that there's been a calling of the election by the media. So this is a unique situation. And one that I think is troubling because it does once more reduce the ability of the Biden team coming in to do everything possible to be ready on day one. And it's impossible to overstate how difficult a circumstance, you know, the Biden team coming in is going to actually have to address. And again, we know some of the current issues on the table, which are overwhelming, but there will be more. And we do need a government that is working well to address these critical problems, and transition is fundamental in their ability to do that.
Can you, by the way, just tick off again some more of the things that usually happen? We know that the incoming, the president-elect, is usually given a tour of the White House. But this incoming president has already been in the White House, so maybe that's not as important. And as some were saying today, maybe may not want to go to the White House at this moment where, you know, there are so many COVID-19 cases. That seems more symbolic. What are some of the other nuts and bolts things that should be happening?
Right. And as you suggest, the, you know, symbolism sometimes matters, but the reality is the more fundamental issues are the need for the Biden team coming in to really have a concrete and in-depth understanding about what is happening in each of the agencies. So we have a very complex government, and there's a lot one can learn about from the outside, but it's ultimately not a complete substitute for hearing from the people inside government. And the second important aspect of this is the ability of the Biden team to process the leadership that they need to bring in with them into each of these agencies, what are so-called the political appointees. And those political appointees often require work with the Office of Government Ethics to ensure that they are not holding any financial conflicts of interest, that they can resolve those. They will need security clearances in many instances, and that requires FBI investigations, et cetera. And ultimately, we should all understand that we have elections. That's how we ensure that our government is accountable to the people. But we need a professional government to be able to address these key problems. And that depends ultimately on cooperation between political leaders who are handing off power and a recognition that all those political leaders need a professional career workforce that they are engaged with in a positive way to be able to get key work done. You look at Dr. Fauci as, in our view, the best example of a fantastic public servant who's a career civil servant doing amazing work. We need more Tony Faucis that are respected and that will solve big problems for us.
Max Dyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic is putting stress on the judicial system. Most states put jury trials and other non-urgent proceedings on hold when the virus broke loose in the spring. Those trials resumed briefly in the summer or fall, but with a new surge underway, judges have suspended them again in places like Boulder and Denver, Colorado. Same goes for some courts in Detroit and Grand Rapids, Michigan, and in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Many trials won't resume now until 2021, and that means a backlog of cases is going to get worse. Joining us now is Josh Landy. He's a defense attorney in Denver and treasurer of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar. Josh, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this with you.
Yeah, sure. So in Colorado and in most of the country, jury trials were paused in the spring for a few months, then resumed in the summer. But now a judge in Colorado has suspended them again until at least January. What kind of problems does that cause the legal system, in your opinion?
Well, I guess I would say it can cause problems mostly with adjudicating people in the system itself. So once a case is started in Colorado, we end up in a situation where the state legislature has directed the courts to give that person a jury trial within 6 months. And now that judges across the state are issuing orders stopping all jury trials, it becomes really difficult as a criminal defense lawyer to get your client the right to a trial within 6 months of being charged and sometimes arrested and placed in custody.
So what does that mean? Because in our system of law, defendants have the right to a speedy trial. There's a saying that justice delayed is justice denied. I mean, do you think that people's rights are being violated because these trials have been postponed?
Yes, I think some people's rights are being violated because the cases are being postponed. So if you look at the types of people who are accused of committing crimes, you sort of have people who fit into two categories mainly. One is people who are charged with crimes and can't afford to post bond, or for some reason just aren't able to post bond given the charges in their case. And then you have people who are permitted to post bond and are able to do so and remain out of custody. And we have two different classes of people when their system is divided in that way. You have individuals who are stuck in custody, and as we all know, Colorado's number of COVID cases is skyrocketing, particularly in jails, right? So you have jails like El Paso County Sheriff's Office released its numbers. Over 600 inmates are infected with the COVID-19 virus. I think over 20 staff members are currently infected, or at least as of last week. And so these jails become, you know, breeding grounds for the virus itself. And people who are unable to post bond are stuck in this area where they're likely to contract a disease that could put their health at risk. And the only mechanism they have for being released is having a trial and hoping that they are acquitted and released, or in some cases, very sadly, having a trial and then being sentenced to probation. There are lots of people who spend a significant amount of time incarcerated before they're able to have a jury trial, only to be released on a probationary sentence.
Hmm. You know, we're all doing things differently these days, remotely and virtually, and that includes court proceedings. Could you have a jury trial on a video conference call?
It would be exceedingly difficult to fairly conduct a jury trial in a video call or over the phone. Most people who are practicing, I think, judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, are realizing that the virtual courtrooms that have been created are fantastic for many things, such as preliminary matters being addressed in court, brief pretrial conferences. But when it comes to actually looking at evidence, sharing evidence, manipulating evidence, communicating with witnesses effectively, there are way too many shortfalls for it to accomplish what it would need to in order to be effective. And you also have to remember, in the United States and in Colorado, every defendant has a right to confront the witnesses who are called to testify against him. And part of what that means is you have the right to effectively cross-examine those witnesses. And it's virtually impossible with virtual courtrooms to do that.
Yeah. And these delays have caused a backlog in jury trials. How bad is it? And how long do you think it will take to work through it once they're back up and running?
That's another good question. I have no idea how long it will take to work through the backlog. One of the reasons is it's really difficult to identify how far into the future the backlog will go. As of right now, you have jurisdictions like Jefferson County, Colorado, right next to Denver, who have suspended jury trials until January 18th of 2021. But this is obviously an order that's been entered successively after a number of other orders that have delayed jury trials for months at a time. And so if we were to stop today, there would be a significant backlog that may take 6 months to a year to resolve. But it seems as though we're probably going to be getting more orders in the future that have similar results in terms of delays. So I think that's a really great question that is almost impossible to answer.
Mm. Josh Landy, defense attorney in Denver, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
What's next for the transition of power as President-elect Joe Biden starts to build his cabinet, and ballot counting and lawsuits continue? That's next time on Here and Now.